Welcome to Try Not to Blink. Today's show is all things peds. We'll talk about our top tips for seamlessly working with kids, not for kids, in your clinic. Then we'll talk about a new eye drop coming to market to help make dilating faster and easier, especially for kids. And then we'll bring on our guest, pediatrician Dr. Kara Buma, who will enlighten us on how pediatricians manage their daily workload, how optometry can be an ally, our role in checking for child abuse, and we'll wrap up with some amazing life tips on how to manage it all.
We're concerned about fractures. Retinal hemorrhages are often the sign of non-accidental trauma in our little babies. Then they need to be seen right away. So you need to admit them to the hospital because you have a window of time to be able to capture, bone fractures, eye findings suggestive of like a shaken baby.
We'd like to thank the amazing people at Valley Contacts who have made this podcast possible. Makers of stellar gas-permeable lenses and the incredible custom-stable scleral lens. I'm your host, Dr. Roya Habibi, and joining me is Dr. Sheila Morrison. Sheila, let's do this.
Hey, Roya. How are you today?
Lovely. Lovely. This topic today is fun, and thank you for coordinating this amazing guest. It's a very fun one. We haven't had a pediatrician before. Pediatric ophthalmologist, different. But a pediatrician... You guys have to listen to the entire episode because she is a gem. She's a local pediatrician to you, correct?
She is. And pediatricians are a little different in Canada, the States. I noticed when I was there, pediatricians tend to do like almost every kid. Like I remember when Ava was born, it wasn't go to your primary care doctor. It was like they have to have a pediatrician. Here in Canada, it's more of a specialty thing. So Ava has never seen a pediatrician here in Canada and they are so busy. They usually will be seeing kind of more like referrals and specialty cases and things like that. And I think this is, I mean, it's such an important ally to have is to know who in your area offers services for kids, who to refer to. And then on the other side of it, I love co-collaborating and managing with other health professions. And we on our side on optometry really have the opportunity to kind of make ourselves known. So in our community, what we have done in the past is have a letter that's ready to go kind of highlighting and teaching about the services that we offer for kids, including myopia control and contact lens and primary care and learning and things like that, and bring them to our pediatricians so that they have great allies as well in who they can send these families to for their eye care.
I like that idea. Especially as a new doc in your area, if you're new to your area or move somewhere and want to start establishing yourself, that's a great person to reach out to is your local pediatricians, especially if you're interested in working with kids, which leads me to my next comment. What were you going to say though?
Not just the kid too, but also then you get their whole family.
100%.
So you get one Mom. Pediatrician referring one patient back to you, and then you end up inheriting, getting the rest of their family, the siblings, parents, and word of mouth. So like the young families Absolutely. Are such great referral sources, in
100%. 100%. That's a great point. Well, I want to talk about even just seeing kids, because I know in my early career, it was like kind of scary. I don't know why, but what do you think?
It can be like you have not only a kid who you don't know what they're going to say and do, and they don't know what they're, who you are. And then you have the parents often looking over your shoulder. And so it can be sometimes feel like more pressure. They're harder to predict sometimes, or they can have the perception is that that's what can happen. I think kids are sometimes harder to get good measurements on when they're really small than like a routine adult exam. It's far more predictable. We can take more imaging, a little bit easier. So it can be a little bit intimidating. But in reality, once you get good at it, I mean, the kids are the best. They're so much fun.
They're so fun. It's such a fun, like you have to really change your flow. You kind of were saying that, right? Like it's not, you can't do your same steps. You can't say your same things in your normal exam or your normal workup. So you do have to truly have a different flow when you talk with kids. But let's give our listeners some tips on how you do things a little differently for a kid's exam. So let's start, first of all, dilating drops for kids. Or let's go first, checking eye pressure. How do you teach your staff to talk to kids when you're about to check their eye pressure?
You know, you can kind of make it a little game, and I think the language is important. So we use an eye care. We don't do air puffs or anything like that. And we basically use, like, we would never, that this is going to come and touch you or touch your eye, because they really don't feel that it's touching. And it'd be like, this little guy is going to come and give you a little kiss, or just it's going to come and come close to just whisper to your tears, just using things like that and move it along. So don't, like, hover. If you're going to take a measurement, you don't sit there and hold it there for 20 seconds waiting for that perfect angle.
You may not get your green outcome.
Yeah.
You may not get your green outcome. It might be yellow.
Yeah. Yeah. Just go for it.
But just get it.
Yeah. Get it done. But those little things, I mean, I love that even with my daughter. I think there's ways that you can get them to do things by making it kind of like a fun, you know, I'm going to put this spray on you. It's a pixie dust, or you're going to, you know, it just, however you can say it to make it just a little bit more fun, even just for 2 seconds to sort of distract them from whatever they may be afraid of in the moment.
It is scary because I think kids just are scared of an exam in general, right? Like, maybe they got shots, maybe, you know, they have different things that they associate doctors to. So it's always a little scary because they just don't know what's coming. But one of my bad experiences in the past, they could have.
And then without having that frontal lobe fully developed to rationalize through the experience, they're like, have a response. Sometimes it comes from something else that had happened.
Totally. Well, what someone, not me, I think Hannah, my last technician that I worked with, or somebody came up with, might have actually been Dr. Fabiola, but she uses our eye care and says, I'm going to take a picture of your eye. I have to get really close. And kids are so familiar with taking pictures now, right? They open, they smile. And so they're like down to take a picture.
That's a great tip.
I think it was Hannah who said, I'm going to tickle your eyelashes. It's going to tickle your eyelashes. Yeah. So it's going to get close. So those are good ones that really work well for us. The camera one, I've started using myself when I do end up taking eye pressure, works like a charm.
Amazing.
Let's talk about putting eye drops in. Mm-hmm. Always something that kids will just start crying about because they're scared, right? They don't even know what an eye drop is or what it feels like, which it does usually burn a little, to be fair. But what do you say when you're putting drops in?
Oh, burn a little. When was the last time you had dilating drops in?
It's been a long time.
Like, why do I do this to people?
What do you say?
Yeah. So when I do it, I'll say my first approach is to, I don't want to be associated with that experience. So I have my technicians do it because they take the hit. That's like pretty typical.
Yes, obviously.
Our staff bless them because they take the brunt of so much that honestly abuse from patients at the front desk.
Yes.
They're the ones that have to, like, you know, especially
love
with
them.
Drops and And I like having them do it because, you know, cause they do sting and I don't have to deal with it. And then the doctor comes in and they're not scared of me, especially the little ones that for the first time, they won't see the tech again that day, but they'll see me for longer.
Yes.
The best way I think is to get it done and get it done quickly, but we have them lean back, close their eyes and put a drop in the corner and then ask them, like, to hold them down so they can't just sit up and then have them say, how many fingers am I holding up? Or can you count my hand? Or, oh, look at this bunny. And then it makes them open their eyes or something, a light, anything to get them blinking. But the key is you can't let them wiggle and turn so that the drop just runs on their cheek when they're sort of fighting back against it. That's what we do. Do you have any tips?
Okay. This also wasn't my idea, but someone else came up with it. But we say, okay, we're going to put a magic drop in your eye. It's going to make your vision kind of like zombie vision.
That's fun.
And
what if they're scared of zombies?
But then we say, I know that does come up sometimes, but usually for boys, that works really well.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah.
We'll say, my last kid told me that this drop tastes like strawberries. Will you tell me if that's true? And they'll be like, it tastes like strawberries. And then the question is very gentle, right? It's like, okay, I want you to kind of weird, close your eyes, look up. Same approach for you. Chin up, eyes closed, put it at the corner of the eye, have them open and immediately focus their thoughts on taste and not pain, right? So it stings a little.
Smart.
Right away, kind of have a tissue ready and just that pressure on the eye kind of helps with the pain. So I'll do that to help a little alleviate some of the pain, but that's my trick. And it usually is pretty good because then right away they might cry a little because they're hurting, but then pretty quickly they'll be like, it tasted exactly like strawberries or no, it tasted like whatever.
It tasted like cotton candy.
Right. They'll just say something else. And so lightens the...
Did it really taste like that or did it taste like gross?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't like to think about pain or I don't like to say this is going to hurt. I'll say it feels like going in the pool. Have you ever opened your eyes in the pool?
Yeah.
But I heard it tastes like strawberries and then boom, right away. So it usually is helpful. I mean, obviously you have your outliers.
I'm going to share that with my staff. That's a great tip. I love that.
It's a good one.
Well, the distraction thing is key, I think, in like the, yeah, that's wicked good idea to have them just suddenly be focused on a different sense, like different sense. Yeah. And then they can really just sort of move on, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't it funny? Some of the really ones that you think would be, it's just like anything. Sometimes the ones that you think are going to just flip out are they just have care. That hat they're on so that day that they're brave sometimes. And they don't even care. They don't even blink. They're just like,
yep, God, I wish all my adults were like you.
Right.
The other pearl I'll say is I like to just call every test that we do a game. I say, we're going to play some eye games today. So whether it's stereo or vision test or whatever, it's all a different game. Are you ready for the next game? And that helps a lot with just, again, that apprehension to what they're doing and performance and things like that. So eye games is my recent thing. So it sort of makes it a lighthearted game. My last thing I'll say is I always say when I'm doing BAO, I show them the light on my hand first. And then I'll say, and now I'm going to look into your eyes and it lets me read your mind.
Yeah.
And honestly, I don't usually say anything else. And it like, I love watching kids be like, it's like, ooh, you can just see them being like, oh my God, I got to think good. I got to think good.
Yeah. Don't, yes. Control my thoughts.
Exactly. Yeah. It's super cute to watch. And parents love that.
Yeah.
Before we go to our guest, which is amazing, I want to say one thing real quick. So this was actually FDA approved last year. So March, 2023, Mydcombi. So this is from Eyenovia. It is a, first fixed dose combination ophthalmic spray. So it's tropicamide phenylephrine combined.
I heard about this.
And it actually, they're using their OptiJet dispenser, which by now most people know what that is, but basically it's this weird looking like rectangular thing that you squeeze and it releases a micro dose of whatever treatment. They have a lot of different applications now, but the only one FDA approved at this moment is the Mydcombi drop. But they show a 96% success rate in the first attempt of drop use with technician. It beats the blink reflex, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. And this OptiJet uses the same technology as printer, actually. So it's using these micro droplets, spraying it like pixels toward the eye. So very low volume, but it gets to the eye really quickly. So it's a very cool option, a much lower volume getting to the eye. So there's no overflow. Less exposure to preservative and toxicity, et cetera. So pretty cool. It's not available, but they just gave an update to their executive board, I guess you would say. Like, their stuff is coming. So I think they're just getting ready to go to market with it. But it will be really cool. So whether it's you, your staff, whatever, but having another option to quickly put a drop in for kids, less torture. And also it could be used across the clinic, but it can be used standing or sitting, which is pretty cool.
Is pretty cool.
Yeah. Cool new options available.
So we are wanting to welcome Dr. Kara Bouma onto the show today. Complete rock star guest. She is a pediatrician based in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and got her medical degree from the University of Calgary back in 2013. So a decade later, she is a pediatric specialist practicing at a clinic called the Ladybug Pediatrics that's located in one of the busiest, biggest hospitals in the city. So we'll link some information about Kara or Dr. Bouma in our show notes as well. Now, she's also an assistant professor, woman of many, many hats, an educator at the University of Calgary, and is a lead for inpatient beds at our second biggest site in Calgary, the Peter Lougheed Hospital. So, Kara, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're really kind of pumped to dig into some of the things that you see in your practice related to pediatric eye care and maybe kind of a couple other tips for anyone out there that was trying to get along with pediatricians.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. It's actually my first podcast. So I appreciate the invitation.
Love getting to do this together as a first. It's going to be your most fun ever.
You know, the first thing that you do, like, you know, any first in life, those tend to be kind of the most memorable. Like, I like always say, okay, if you're the first to go through a program, for example, our current contact lens resident, I tell her, I'm like, you are going to go down as history as the first and you'll always remember. So we hope that we will be your historical memory of your very first podcast that you start in.
I have no doubt that it will be.
Well, hey, I want to just start right away, and it's always fun to hear like why people do what they do, but Why did you want to become a pediatrician in this day and age of medicine and how everything's changed? Like, why did you decide this is the line of work that you wanted to spend your life doing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I went into medical school just so grateful to be there. I really felt that I was surrounded by all these brilliant people that had done PhDs, and, you know, I was just grateful to be there, and they could go do the subspecialty training and I was going to do family medicine. And it took about a month of medical school for me to realize, oh, I belong here, and I like details and I like weird and wonderful. And so I decided that I wanted to do internal medicine, which is, you know, the whole body system, and lots of different complex problems. And as I went through my training, I started to wonder if maybe I would want to do pediatrics because I enjoy working with children. And so I had done all my internal medicine rotations, and at the end of it, I sort of felt like, I don't know, maybe ready for something different. And then I started my pediatric rotations and I just loved it. And I had no problem getting out of bed for little ones in the middle of the night who needed me. So I have no regrets. I'm very grateful to work with children every day. And I really enjoy what I do.
So I love that. No regrets. If I just want to, like, let's be podcasty here and say, what is something who, like, a tip for someone who is maybe interested in getting into pediatrics as like a, I love this, but beware that this is what's up. You know what I mean? Is it parents? Is it the system? You know, is it?
I think the thing everyone worries about is the parents. Of course. I actually had a med student shadow me on Friday, and at the end of, she joined me in clinic. I work in the clinic and I also work in the hospitals. And at the end of the day, she said, are there always so many discussions with parents? And it sort of made me laugh. Yes. Because yes, there are. So I think that is the big piece that people sometimes feel a little bit put off by, is that you don't just get to treat a little baby or a toddler. It's all about what the parents' philosophies are around healthcare, you know, what their approaches are, and you have to very much counsel them and guide them. And I think we're just as much a therapist as we are physicians. And so you have to be open to communicating with multiple people in the room and hearing multiple opinions and being able to navigate complex conversations. Yeah, but I really feel that's the case in so many of our jobs, right? Like, if you work in healthcare with older people, you're going to be also, you know, managing the spouses and the children. Absolutely. The adult children that have opinions, and, you know, in your career in ophthalmology too, it's not just the patient. There are always outside opinions. And so you just need to be a people person, I think, to be able to do the job well.
I love totally. This. I feel like we just bonded over my thought. If I was to pick off, you know, the MD walking into the room in and out, I would imagine that some of the role falls on, like, your assistants. There's just so many patients that you as a specialist would see in, like, a hospital setting. And I love this because I've prided myself as an optometrist in having, that is one of our main responsibilities. And the way that the world is, it's a very competitive market. And so if you're not taking that time, especially in the myopia clinic, to really connect with parents and make kind of team decisions, then you kind of fall by the wayside and people just aren't happy. They, you know, you could provide the same service, but if you're not communicating what you're doing and taking time to make sure people feel heard, you know, we're really not, patients are not happy at the end of the day, even if you're the best doctor in the world, you know?
Absolutely. And I mean, I love medicine. I love complexity. One of the things that we do well in the clinic I work at is see children with quite complex medical conditions and rare genetic conditions. And I love nerding out on the medicine. But honestly, one of the most satisfying moments for me in a day is when I have a family that we like to call the worried well. So a child that really is perfect, but parents are quite anxious and have lots of different concerns. And when you can just kind of alleviate those concerns with rational thought and, you know, just kind of talking families through it, and they feel so much better. And when someone says, oh, I always feel so much better after I come see you, those are some of the most satisfying conversations. So I really don't mind at all. I don't mind the different opinions, and I don't mind the occasional debate over the science and the medicine. So
occasional, do you get a lot of, is the key word, right?
Occasional, yeah. Right, yeah. Where it's like Dr. Google has taught them everything about that genetic condition, and they are going to tell you what is up. Yeah. Amazing. So you still get that too. So we're not as far apart as optometrists and pediatric MDs as we may sometimes feel. What about on the flip side? Do you ever have parents that you get in the clinic, or do you have cases where kids will get referred in and parents just couldn't be bothered, and you really have to try to explain to them how important things are, like follow-ups or whatever it is?
Absolutely, I do. Those ones are some of the hardest because you're worried, right? And I think it's natural, depending on your personality, but I think certainly as women in a healthcare position, I think we tend to take on a little bit of a mothering sentiment sometimes. Like, I worry about my patients, I think about them. And so when I have a parent that's not as worried as I am and not following through with some of the recommendations, it's really hard. And I think it's a fine balance between maintaining a relationship with that family, but also strongly emphasizing that something needs to happen. Like, this child needs support, or you need to, you know, seek that subspecialty consultation that I've referred you for. You can't not answer your phone. Those ones are hard. And I mean, there are times, and this is rare, but there are times where you do need to involve child and family services to make sure that a child is not being neglected for serious medical conditions.
Can I ask you how you would recommend, or how you handle those situations when, because we all have them in the clinic, where there's, you know, you suspect abuse or you suspect something that's going on, because that's a tricky one. Do you have resources, or how do you handle it if you have a kid in the clinic that you suspect is not being taken care of properly?
Yeah, so I think that's sort of a two-pronged situation. So one is a well-meaning parent that just doesn't have the tools and strategies. And so the child's not getting the services they need because the parent either maybe themselves has an intellectual disability or anxiety or depression or socioeconomic barriers. In those cases, I really try to support the parent. Depending on the age of the child, there are services. Here in Calgary, we have our mental health resources through Access Mental Health. And there is a program called the Early Childhood Rehabilitation Program, or it has like a short-term name called ECMO. And social workers will support parents up to the age of 5. So they will follow families and go in the home and support them. So if you can get them access to services that are a little more hand-holding, then that can be really helpful for those scenarios. When it's a situation where you're truly concerned about abuse, right? So we call it non-accidental trauma in medicine, or NAT. That is something that needs to be reported. So we do have a child abuse team. So there's always a child abuse physician on call through the Children's Hospital. So if you were ever concerned, you could always call Switchboard at the Children's Hospital and ask to speak to the child abuse physician on call. And you can go through your concerns. They will open a file. That physician is attached with the Calgary Police. And there's a team that reviews all the cases and the calls that come through every morning. They do a triage to go through and decide how they're going to escalate the concern. If you're ever concerned to the degree that this child needs immediate evaluation, right? If we're concerned about fractures, retinal hemorrhages are often the sign of, of non-accidental trauma in our little babies, then they need to be seen right away. So you need to admit them to the hospital because you have a window of time to be able to capture, bone fractures, eye findings suggestive of like a shaken baby, things like that. So you can always call the police. You can form 10, right? So getting someone admitted to hospital against their will as a concerned citizen, you can call the police and they form them and bring them to the hospital. And there's a 24-hour window where the physician decides if they continue the form, if they continue to keep someone against their will, which more for adults. For kids, we have a little bit more authority to keep them because they can't, they can have assent, but they can't have consent for decision making.
Wow, one thing I just got the shivers from that, like the retina, because it's like that's just such a crazy scenario, and we do see that.
I want to remind everyone listening to just to like really take home that point. If you see, it's bilateral, right? Bilateral retinal hemorrhages in a kid. I don't think there's an age requirement really, right? But I guess it's more likely going to be in a little, like a under toddler age, yeah? Mm-hmm. But if you see bilateral retinal hemorrhages, you are to assume that it's some form, I know that sounds sad, or like, I guess I can't think of another reason that a kid would have it. There could be some other retinal conditions perhaps that could do it, but you have to assume first that it could be shaken baby syndrome above all else. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the only kind of window of time that we think maybe it's just other trauma would be birth trauma. So kind of in the first couple of weeks of life, you might see unilateral or maybe bilateral retinal hemorrhage from a very significant birthing situation, a long time in the birth canal, multiple vacuums or forceps or something like that. But otherwise, I agree with you. That's sort of what we're taught in medicine too, is that bilateral retinal hemorrhage is not accidental trauma until proven otherwise. The other thing I think about is bleeding disorder. So an innate bleeding disorder, inherited bleeding disorder, could potentially have spontaneous bleed like that. Sure. But I would, you know, lean on the expertise of our child abuse physicians and our ophthalmologists to help determine the etiology.
Okay, so just to lay out a plan for anyone who sees this. So you see a kid, maybe it's a one-year-old, comes in, you see bilateral retinal hemorrhages. Step one, leave the room. What would you say as a recommendation?
I would ask some questions. So I think I would just like get a, you know, not accusatory questions, but I think I would just have a little bit of curiosity with the family. Okay. Tell me about the home situation, who lives in the home, who cares for this child. Like, you could do that. I mean, it all depends on where you feel your level of curiosity and responsibility lay. But I would call Child and Family Services and report it. Mm-hmm. And that way it's always documented, right? So even if an investigation happens and it turns out to be, you know, some other reason for it, when you call Child and Family Services, it opens a file and that gets the right people involved.
Perfect. I like that recommendation. You don't necessarily have to be the instigator, but at least be looking out for that child, because like, unless it's a very odd outlying reason, you are going to potentially be saving this kid.
Yeah. And I would also say, if that's the case, I wouldn't just send them home. I would, you know, say whatever you need to say that this child needs to go to the emergency room. And then you can call ahead to the emergency room as well. So as a physician, you just call, the hospital has to speak to the emergency physician on call, mm-hmm. and you can give them a handover. I told this family that I was worried about whatever, which sent them to the emergency room, but I'm actually worried about this. And that will kind of cue the, because then you don't have to send them with the letter that they themselves, right? So you can call ahead and have that
sealed
for our referral pathway. I actually really appreciate this conversation, because I'm curious. So would you say that the referral pathway does not have to be straight to a pediatric ophthalmologist, but the pediatric physician at the eMERGE would be completely appropriate?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you could send to ophthalmology, but if you send to eMERGE, they're going to involve more team members to think about what's going on.
most emergency really departments have an on-call ophthalmologist.
Exactly.
If they don't have
so they'd
one
come
on
down
staff.
There anyways. Yeah. Because, yeah. You know, I don't know if it's like this, you know, if you guys are all aware, but pediatric ophthalmology where I am is super hard because there's not very many of them and they're so, so busy that it, even for really difficult cases, it can even, like if it's not, eyeball's not falling out, they're going to wait. So I actually love this tip. Thank you. I'm going to bring this back, honestly, to next time I'm on a podium for our association and just recommend, just give some ideas of what to do. Because sometimes it's hard to know the right person and that can really change the life of the little ones if they're in that position.
I have a question less severe, if you will. I'll start by saying like I have such just like good memories of like my childhood growing up and going to my pediatrician. Like you have to screen everything. Like literally anything was wrong, whether like it was an elbow or literally anything, it fell on you. Like I feel like it's this catch-all, obviously physician, but it's just like you are just have to worry about every kid who's the worst reporter, you know, that you just hope that you can kind of figure it out. But to narrow down on eyes a little bit, I want to talk about like what you do for eyes specifically so we can best be a partner to our local pediatricians or whatever. So kind of what is your general protocol when you're screening eyes in kids?
Yeah, I love that question because I do think sometimes we underutilize our subspecialty colleagues such as yourselves. So I work in a few different areas. So I work in the hospital. In the hospital, I see newborns and do the newborn exam. And then I also do inpatient admissions. So common pediatric problems, many of which have eye findings and are eye related. And then in the community clinic here in Calgary, pediatricians are more subspecialty based. So we do take referrals based on a question. So this child has X going on, can you please explore it, versus primary care, which falls more to our family doctors. If we think about sort of the recommendations from the Canadian Pediatric Society, it is that we ask about eyes and do an eye exam on every well child visit, so every kind of 6 to 12 months, which the recommendations include that we not only examine the eyes, look at the red reflex with our ophthalmoscope, but also do some visual acuity testing as well. To be totally honest with you, I don't do visual acuity testing unless I'm concerned, unless there's something mm-hmm. about the history. I've got blurry vision, I've got double vision, I've been having headaches, I have migraine symptoms with aura, things like that. Then we do have a Snell chart in the hallway and I would take a child out there and I would do some visual acuity testing. But mostly I do depend on ophthalmologists and primary optometrists to do visual acuity testing. The things that I do in pediatrics are kind of age dependent. So for our newborns, on the newborn exam, kind of the biggest message that I take home for my learners that join me is really getting a good, crisp view of that red reflex. And the biggest thing that we are thinking about for that, if we're having obscurity of the red reflex, is retinoblastoma. So a tumor at the back of the eye that children can be born with. And so an asymmetrical red reflex is an urgent referral to an ophthalmologist because it's retinoblastoma until proven otherwise. There are a couple other things on the differential that I have seen that can happen, but really that's the big one that we're trying not to miss. And so the eye exam for us for a newborn is more assessment of symmetry. You can get asymmetrical eyes with some congenital infections. So the one that I think about is congenital varicella syndrome. So if a mom doesn't have immunity to chickenpox or varicella and she gets varicella in the pregnancy, the infant can have quite significant systemic findings. But the big one is sometimes they get asymmetrical microophthalmia, so small eye on one side. And so to me, that's congenital chickenpox until proven otherwise. So we're really looking at the symmetry of the eyes. You know, we're not expecting conjugate gaze in the newborns, right? So they can have wandering eyes, but really looking at the red reflex, looking at the symmetry, and then looking for any subtle features that might suggest dysmorphism, that might suggest a genetic syndrome. So, I mean, the most common one that we think about is Down syndrome, right? So a baby right. with Down syndrome has fairly classic, like almond shape, upslanting eyes. The wide palpebral fissures, you know, the widely spaced eyes, Noonan syndrome, also have hypertelorism, almond-shaped eyes. So there are certain things that we can just visually inspect for the newborn. If they have increased suspicion for genetic syndrome, I always involve ophthalmology to do an eye exam to look for other retinal findings that are consistent with certain genetic disorders. For my inpatients, lots of different eye considerations when we're thinking about infectious versus inflammatory versus autoimmune disorders as well. And maybe we can talk about that a little bit later. And then in the clinic, really, I'm not doing an extensive eye exam. I always look at the eye. I mean, I'm always trying, you know, to
you have
look
a million things to do,
nerve.
Right? There's so goodness. Many things. But I think right, what an yeah. important thing for us that we should be hearing as you're talking about this is that we need to like be an ally to you, right? Like we need to communicate with our local pediatricians and we need to go meet them or whatever and just be, because some optometrists, this is not optometrists only, some healthcare providers are truly scared of working with kids. And this is eye totally. Care also. I think some... I mean, this is every specialist too. It's like, I don't see kids under 12. I don't see kids under 8, whatever it might be. Although in my opinion, I think kids are truly some of the easiest to work with. Fear aside, because crying usually comes up with fear, right? Yeah. But if you are comfortable and interested in seeing kids and hopefully helping out the community, the best thing to do is reaching out to your pediatrician and saying, hey, I'm here. I want to help you. Because I know you are wearing a million other hats and have a million other things to worry about. So I would love to be a resource to any of your families in our area or in my area that you just want to have. You're a little worried about your strabismus or, mm-hmm. you know, maybe it's not so much like an urgent white red reflex thing, but something's just not making sense, or mom says kids having trouble reading or whatever it might be, or getting ready mm-hmm. for school, and parents have history of other issues with their eyes. So these are like, I think it's important for us to know that we all can help each other, right?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, vision and hearing screening are number one and number two on the things that we can do while we're waiting for, you know, blood work for genetic testing or neurology to assess when there's anything, pretty much anything going on, right? If we're worried about how a child's doing in school and we're screening for ADHD, you know, if we can't see the board, we're not going to do well with printing and keeping up with the schoolwork. So it's really like the low-hanging fruit, the bread and butter recommendations that we can do for families while we're exploring what else is going on, what else could be happening for a child, is to make sure that they have vision screening and that they have a hearing screen and that those two things aren't getting in the way. I mean, always I recommend at every single patient, every single family, every time I see them, I always ask about the last time they had an eye exam. Especially knowing like here in Alberta, eye exams are free once a year for kids under 18. So there should be no barrier for them to be able to have an optometrist appointment. When it comes to examining a kid and being afraid or just nervous or just not enjoying it.
Yes, let's hear your tips.
So many basic, really common sense tips that I think sometimes we forget about as adults. A child, especially like a toddler 4 and under, doesn't want a towering presence over them, right? So I think the easiest first starting point for examining a child is to squat down. And I do it every time I do it. I put the kid up on the table in the office and I squat down and then show them what you're doing. Show like, this is my stethoscope. Do you want to hold my stethoscope? It goes right here. And I point to where it's going to go. Do you want to hold it there? And even if they're nonverbal, they're 12 months old, they're listening, mm-hmm. they're watching, they know. And if you sort of give them a little bit of a head, like signpost, right? With all yes, right. children, with transition, with change, signpost. These are the things that are going to happen. Don't just go in there and do it, right? And it really takes maybe 30 more seconds of your time. But if you're in a big rush and you're going in there, it's like a puppy. They can feel it. They feel that you don't want to be there and you're in a rush and they're not going to agree with that, right? So I think
totally.
If you can set the stage, distraction, a toy, a light, yes. something, distraction, something fun, genuinely seem to enjoy them, smile at them. All yes. these things go a long way. But I really think like just a few extra seconds of patience rather than like, well, we're just going to get this done, goes a long way for building rapport with little ones.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah. Especially, I mean, the eye exam, you're so up close and personal, right? You need totally. To be able to have some trust there. So get down low, have a toy, be patient. I think most of the time you can have success with that.
I think, too, one of the things that's nerve-wracking for most, like, I remember when I first started allowing, because at one of the clinics I worked at last, we could say, what's the age you want to see? And I asked all my peers and they're like, I don't see under 8 or I don't see under 12. So I kind of like copied them in the beginning. And then I was like, what am I doing? Like, I like kids. But I think it's nerve-wracking sometimes that our accuracy, like we cannot feel as confident or accurate in your test findings when you're working with a kid, because you kind of have to like be a little sloppy. You have to get the best view you can. You can't do exactly the steps you would do with an adult. It's going to fatigue a kid, or they're going to be out. They're not going to do that. So mm-hmm. I think too, I don't know, what's your thought on like, if you don't feel like you can dilate today, or dilating usually is pretty easy. You just say we're doing this, right? But like, if you can't get eye pressure like you normally could, maybe scheduling back 6 months or 1 year, you know, sooner, so that you can sort of build that rapport. Or I don't know, what are tips that you would have for that, about worrying about making sure you do it, but not totally traumatizing the kid either, right?
Yeah, we have to make these decisions a lot, actually. Even, you know, would I do routine blood work on this child if I expect the answer to be normal? What am I doing it for? So I think there are things in medicine that we feel better about. I will sleep at night because I was so thorough and I did my checklist. And then there are other questions that you have to ask yourself. How at risk do I think this child is? And so there's lots of situations like that where I find that, you know, if I were going to be really thorough and complete, I would do all the following things and I would check with blood work and I'd do these screening tests. But my, you know, thoughts about how at risk this child is for the following diagnosis is high for the following reason, therefore I'm going to do it. Or I really think this is a healthy child and we have time. I think that's the beauty of outpatient care for the most part, is that we have time. So if there are certain family history risk factors that really kind of tip your concern for increased ocular pressure, then you want to get that test done. And if you can't do it today, maybe you want to bring them back in 2 weeks or whatever, you know, your time frame is to ensure that you feel like you're providing appropriate care. But if it's otherwise a healthy kid with no family history and there are no risk factors and there's nothing really concerning on that history, then you have time. Mm-hmm. I think that's where asking questions really helps a lot. So much of medicine is in the history. What is going on? Absolutely. And I know with kids, you don't always have a good historian in the child, but the caregiver hopefully can give you a pretty good picture of what's going on. And then just part of it too is almost like a little bit of like a fun game, like looking at ears, looking at eardrums and ears and looking for a fusions behind ears. How much can I see in this 2 second period? And how good am I at knowing what I'm looking at? You know, it's like 1,000 ears seen, and I know that's not an ear infection. So there's something about just experience and doing what you can every time with every patient that you're like, oh yes, I've seen this and it's normal, you know, 99.9% of the time. And I think it is this time too. So just kind of trusting your skills also.
Right. I feel that that has a parallel with like papilledema, and totally. It's one of those things that like, that's a big thing that we always have a responsibility to take a peek. And it's actually popping up way more than I ever would have expected in clinic mm-hmm. with kids. Not that it's like every day you have it, but you know, it does come up, and it's a huge, huge thing when it does, just to make sure it's like, oh, if I hadn't looked or hadn't been able to see that, you know, and so it's like getting that view and knowing what is normal, what is not normal. You can blow through a screening, but being quick enough to get the view you need, in particular, look at the optic nerve and just make sure that there isn't something going on that could be more of an emergent sort of thing. So I love that, popping in, being really good at getting that view and differentiating what you see, where you can like identify, okay, perfect, that's not an infection. We can collect data over time with this one and that sort of thing.
Sheila, you find you're seeing more papilledema lately?
More than I expected. Well, actually, do you know, it's funny you mentioned that. One of my colleagues actually believes that they has increased in our office in the last like probably 2 to 3 years. And personally, I have seen more than I would have anticipated in my career. In fact, I think about like, you know, 2 months ago, we had 2 or 3 cases in the same week in kids. It was really wild. Have you seen that?
Well, that's an interesting observation. And I wonder, I mean, obviously the big thing we're worried about is increased intracranial pressure from something pathologic. Yes. Like, is there increased fluid? Is there a brain tumor? And solid organ tumors in the brain are the number one solid organ tumor of kids. So that's the scary thing. But I'm curious to know if we're seeing it more in the context of obesity as well.
Yeah, it's a big question. It could be. And it's just an interesting thing that, you know, we all need to stay connected on to find out kind of what those patterns are and if it's changing a little bit for sure.
Well, I think like on that same note is there are, depending on like in the US, there's different recommendations by the American Pediatric Association. I think that's the letters, but I'm sure there's different technical recommendations from the Canadian board and internationally as well. But I think too, I mean, so often, myself included, like I never had an eye exam till I was in school and like past like until I was in my optometry program, I did not do an eye exam because I had no eye problems. My parents had no eye problems, but I think it goes without saying, especially in anyone that's having any sort of vague problems, headaches, trouble learning, whatever, but doing an eye exam, doing a dilated eye exam, making an effort to truly look into the eye. Don't assume that everything's okay. Don't assume because it's a kid you don't need to check eye pressure. I think just those are important things that we all remember all the time, is that you can never assume that everything's okay in the eye because they're young. That's your
pearl of the day.
That's absolutely.
I love it.
Lots of kids that I follow have a whole smattering of ocular issues, whether that be like strabismus or just astigmatism, or they need glasses, or they're born preterm and they have retinopathy of prematurity and need glasses for that. But I think eye care is just part of routine care. We brush our teeth every day. We see the dentist every 6 months. We need to have our eyes checked every year, whether we're 1 year olds or 50 years old, right? And so that's something that I really emphasize, and certainly our guiding bodies like Canadian Pediatric Society would also support that. So I really would echo that message.
Love that.
You know, our final thing for you is really related to, because I know that you can wear so many different hats. You know, you have balancing family life and your professional life. And I know that you've got, I know this. I don't know why I said heard, but you're a competitive runner as well. How do you balance it all? And what would you say that your biggest tip for stress management and doing it all would be for those that are listening?
Oh yeah, that's a hard question to answer. I think part of my answer comes from a bit of self-reflection in this idea that, and I think we're all around the same generation. I think we all grew up with this sentiment that we can do it all and we're all trying to do it all, right? Like, you can do anything. You're a woman who's growing up in the 90s. You can do anything. You can have a career. You can have family. You can be a great athlete. You can be a Martha Stewart in the home. And I think there's a lot of delusion behind that, that I've had to kind of come to a realization with over the last maybe 2 or 3 years, because my kids are pretty young. They're 9 and 4. And so I do many things, definitely. But I in many ways actually don't want to normalize that we can balance everything and have this like beautiful Giselle Bundchen like balance, you know, yoga pose.
Amen.
Yeah, I think it's not without sacrifice. And I think whatever you choose to pursue, you need to rank it in terms of your priorities. And some weeks the priorities are different than other weeks, and some hour to hour the priorities can be different. And in this moment, I have to be a really excellent physician and focus on clinic. And you know, if I'm getting a call from the school, my husband has to take it, right? And in this moment, I'm training for Boston Marathon, and this hour is mine to do a run. And I'm not going to answer that call from the hospital because someone else
I'm not going to feel guilty. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a challenge. And I've have been working on not working too much because I am very guilty of that. And I love to say yes, and I'm a doer, and I love to do things. So I have pared back some of the work that I do because I was really, you know, the balance was not there. So I think it's just about constant evaluation and being honest with yourself. And I think kind of stripping back that delusion that we need to be perfect in all settings, especially, I really say this, like, especially for us as women, where we feel like we need to have super fit bodies and beautiful faces and no wrinkles and be amazing moms. And, you know, I've got a teaching session last week, and my friend Heidi, our mutual friend Sheila, said, "Don't you dare like bring home baked goods for them, because you're setting like an unachievable precedent. Oh, I work 5 jobs and I made you cookies and I'm going to teach you and I'm going to pick up my kids and go to swimming lessons." Like, that can be possible in some days, but I don't think it should be the target.
The marvelous
that
Mrs. Maisel doesn't need to keep going. Exactly. I love that.
Yeah. It's.
I think
it's
that
okay
is
to
such
not
a.
Check all the boxes every day.
Yeah. We don't have to be like, you can. It's not a like a measure of can. It's a measure of like, why don't you also just enjoy your life? Right.
Yeah. And like, also, it's okay to be messy sometimes. You don't have to be perfect all the time. And in fact, I think everyone around you maybe appreciates you a bit more for it. And you appreciate yourself a bit more for it because you're not carrying the stress of needing perfection.
I love that. I mean, I think that we all just need to sit on that as a last comment for today.
I don't think we can do better than that.
I don't think we can do better. And I think we all need to sit and reflect on this disillusion that we all truly, I think it's a partially millennial thing, partially girl power thing, but also like, I totally agree that it's just, it is toxic, right? Like, it's a toxic trait. The yes, say, always say yes trait is just a rough, rough reality that we are like living through. But regardless, thank you so much for coming on and dropping these pearls of wisdom to us, both in healthcare and in life. We really appreciate your time, considering how many hats you wear. And we hope you do amazing at the Boston Marathon.
Yeah,
and
good luck.
Thank you so
thank
much
you.
For your time.
No, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Well, we have come to the end for today. We want to hear from you, so please reach out to us with your feedback, questions, stories, things you're interested in hearing from us, either through our Instagram or Facebook. And we can't close today's show without saying thanks to Valley Contacts for both making great products and for being amazing people to work with. Be sure to tune in and listen to our next episodes. And until then, try not to blink.